Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
And good morning and welcome to First Coast Connect. I'm Dan Scanlon, sitting in this week for Ann Schindler. Today, Jacksonville's first female mayor finishes the first leg of her four-year term. She joins us to discuss triumphs, challenges, and the road ahead. Later in the program, an award-winning author discusses her new children's book and the importance of embracing our differences. Well, Mayor Deacon, you know, I was there a year ago on that rooftop with a little bit of gentle rain falling, you chiding the first dude about his weather forecast, and it was a very cheerful place to be to hear you say thank you very much and the cheers. And it was impossible to do a live broadcast with WJCT at the time because nobody could hear me. But the bottom line is a year in office, and what a year it has been. So let's just go off that as the first question. Sure. Did you ever think that you would be so inundated with not maybe not controversy, but some heavy hitting things like the stadium, the union contracts with police and fire, the three buildings downtown that aren't and maybe and could be? I mean, it's just been an amazing first year. I guess you did a lot of homework.
Well, a lot of that was in the queue. You know, I think we knew the stadium was coming up. And I think certainly being in the news business for 30 years prepares me for whatever your plans are, get ready to change them at a moment's notice, right? Because you have to pivot to whatever becomes front and center. The affordable housing crisis was one of those things that when I first started to run for office was not at the top of the list and very quickly became something that we had to look at. So I think I was prepared for all that. I don't think there's been anything that's been a huge surprise or a huge problem, to be honest. But I'm enjoying it very much. And I think, you know, you go back to that night on the rooftop, and I remember that the first thing that came out of my mouth was some iteration of Love One Tonight. And I think in a very real sense, Dan, I think if the legacy of the first year has been anything, and I think we've accomplished a lot of big things, I hope it is that we are and are becoming a more unified, love-filled community. When I go out into the community, very often, in fact, happened again this morning. I was out for my morning run, and a gentleman stopped me and said, "I just want to tell you thank you for the positive vibes." He said, "It's nice to feel that way in Jacksonville," and that's really what I wanted to bring. And I think we have begun that process at the very least.
Well, I'm honored to have known you through three iterations of your career. And you've always been a joy to hang out with on the front lines of a story, talking to you about, you know, the Donna 5K and all that, even though it was a mess getting to my mother's, my late mother's retirement facility at one point there off San Pablo. But so let's get down to business, as another person used to say on the radio, and you may remember that person, I won't name them. What's your biggest priority now when it comes to long-term success? You're 1 year in. You got 3 years to go.
Well, I hope I have more than 3 years to go.
Well, at least for this iteration.
they are all the same priorities that I had coming in. The continued lifting of our disinvested portions of our community, I think very, very important to me. A continued focus on making sure that our riverfront becomes everything that it can, that our downtown and surrounding areas become everything that they can. And I want to remind people again, every now and then I will continue to get the question of, why are you so focused on downtown? And my answer continues and will continue to be, because I think it is the key and the ignition to making all of Jacksonville go the way we want it to go. We need to drive people to live downtown. We need to increase the investment in downtown, because that will really help us in those disinvested areas around downtown and in some of those areas that we really need to grow. So it is that piece, I think, that ultimately will help us in the entirety of our city to invest in areas that we really need to invest in. So it's affordable housing. It's homelessness initiatives. It is making sure that we grow small business to become the small business capital of the Southeast. All those things are things we've focused on in the first year and will continue to focus on going forward.
Well, yesterday's guest was our fire chief, and one of the last things he said was he believes in downtown growth and believes that maybe it's time to start thinking on some pocket fire stations to help cover downtown. So two minds thinking alike on that one. Let's just talk about some of the things that have happened. Sure. I mean, you and I have been around here long enough to see, talk about iterations. Friendship Fountain has gone through two iterations in our time.
How wonderful.
And now it's
see?
Back, and it's back big, and I keep on saying, I got to get down there.
People, you cannot move there on those first Fridays. I mean, it is wonderful. I cannot tell you how much I have enjoyed watching children's faces light up when they go to Friendship Fountain. Families are down there. People are bringing their kids, and it's just, I remember when I was a kid, it was such a glorious experience, and now we're seeing a whole new generation enjoy it. And I mean, that has been one of the things that I have so enjoyed watching.
A week ago, we were roasting our noses off at the Lift Every Voice and Sing Park.
Yes, we were.
And that's yet another phase of the Emerald Trail, which I've said to people, amazingly looks just like the concept drawing. So,
yeah.
There's another element, a sort of next
Absolutely.
To downtown that's being done.
Well, as I always say, it's all connected, Dan. You know, that's what I'm saying. If you look at the Emerald Trail, what's so exciting to that about that to me is that it really does connect so many of our neighborhoods. And if we continue to do that right, and I know that we will, KE House is doing just an amazing job there. We're bringing the community into that process. The community's vision is becoming that vision. And I think that as you see those dots connecting all through not only downtown but in those other neighborhoods, you're just going to see a blossoming that you're really already starting to see.
For me, I remember a chilly morning with Jimmy Peluso and I standing on the fence as a Confederate monument was removed. Mm-hmm. And we have a caller here, but just your quick comments on the status of the Confederate monument situation as it stands now and in the future. They're physically gone. What next? And just your thoughts about getting that done.
Well, I think that it was one of those things that I certainly promised during the campaign that I would do, and I think it needed to happen. We really want all of our community to feel valued, and I think to leave that monument up to a time when we simply did not recognize each other's humanity fully was just a disservice to our community, and I'm glad that we were able to do it. I don't know what next steps will be at this point, but I hope it is in re-envisioning what we want for that park. But I'm proud of that moment. And I still have a picture that sits in my office of a little boy with his camera trained on the monument coming down and looking back, I suppose, at his mother or whoever was behind him with this big smile on his face. And I think it's so important for our community to come together and to really have respect for every portion of our city. And I think that was a big step in that direction.
Well, we always want to tell you folks about this time of the morning that we invite your calls, especially now with the mayor. So give us a call at 904-359. Golly, I can't remember the phone number. Isn't that 359-2937? And we have a caller, Wells Todd. Good morning, Wells. So you got a question on the Confederate statues.
Good morning, Dan, and good morning, Mayor Deegan.
Good morning, Wells.
And, I want to thank you again for having the backbone to remove those statues that were in Springfield Park. I do want to ask a question, though. The $500,000 that was set aside for the removal of the statue was never really touched. And I'm seeing here that money is going to be placed back in the general fund.
It is not. It is not, Wells. It actually is not. That money is in the CIP. And that money is being removed.
Right.
That money is being removed from the CIP, because if we were ever going to go back and do anything else in that park, we'd have to go back and restart the process anyway. So that money was for the removal of the monument. So that money we are doing our very best to clean up that CIP and make sure that we have things in there that are absolutely necessary. And that's one of those things that, fortunately, because we were able to have the private sector involved, we didn't have to use any city funds for that project. And so that's coming out of the CIP this year.
All right. Thank you, Wells. Let's move on to the big tiger, the big jaguar in the room, obviously, is that billion-dollar Jaguar Stadium deal and the piece that's still on the table. Where do we stand now? You've got the deal approved. We now work on getting that stadium rebuilt right across the street from us. But there's still, when that city council comes back, you're going to be on them, I guess, to work on that community part.
Well, absolutely. First of all, let me say that I am extraordinarily proud of my team, of the entire city in terms of that agreement. The council president and I were in lockstep in that we wanted that agreement done on the 25th of the month. We We were absolutely laser focused on it. And I can tell you that it was probably one of the more difficult planes that I have had to land, just because there was a very strong feeling that we were not going to get done in time. And we had just such an extraordinary team. And then to be able to give it over to council and to have the council president coalesce the body to get it done in a timely manner was, I think you're going to see over time, just given the fact that there's so much that falls apart when things go too long, that this was an extraordinarily important thing to get done quickly for costs and everything else. So very pleased we got it done. CBA, extraordinarily important also. We'll be coming back to council on the 23rd, asking them to approve the rest of the CBA. I don't know if you recall that initially it was broken apart because there were certain council members that had conflicts there. We're going to come back. We're going to ask them to pass the rest of it. Affordable housing initiatives, homeless initiatives, workforce development initiatives that are critically important to making sure that we have the workforce in this city to actually get all these projects done that are in the pipeline. All those things are very, very important, in addition to the fact that we've already now invested in our riverfront parks. And the east side piece, I think that is where we're probably going to have to do the least amount of selling. I think the east side folks have done a great job of showing up and advocating for why that piece is so important. But I'm looking forward to working with the council committee that's being formed on that and to getting that across the finish line, hopefully by the end of August.
Roger Dodger on that one. Now, your thoughts on a recent Office of General Inspector General report on the Clara White mission involving a city council colleague, and just any thoughts on that with Jacoby Pittman and the claims of just came out with that report?
Well, look, I will just say this. I think that it's very, very important for us to make sure that we are having as much accountability as we can possibly have. And so I think that we are looking at measures to put in place to make sure there is more accountability. We've done that in every step of this last year with our transparency boards and things that we've done. We've looked at accountability across the board, and we've asked every department to look at ways in which we can improve accountability. I think this is just another one of those things that we need to look at and say, how can we make sure that these issues really don't bite us in the future?
Is it tough when you have city council members or any elected official who has a day job and they have to recuse themselves or make sure they recuse themselves if something even tangentially comes in as legislation? Generally, all these years, we've seen people who have to back off, and you don't know why until you maybe ask them later.
Well, let me say this, and I have great respect for all of our city council people. As much as I would have hoped that Mike Gay's vote would have been different on the stadium, I respected the fact that what he said was, in order to vote, he was simply going to take his company out of the process if in the future there was any possibility that they would receive funds. I respect that. There is nothing that says that council folks can't say, you know what, I'm going to take my organization out of the mix should anything ever come back. And that sort of removes any opportunity for conflict then, doesn't it?
Okay.
So I think that if this is not going to become a continuing issue for us, because certainly we're always going to have people who are involved in other good things in the community, unless city council becomes a full-time job, which is certainly something we can look at for the future. But I do think there are choices there. And I think that is certainly something that Mike Gay availed himself of, and other council people could as well.
Yeah, I knew the Gay family back in my election campaign consultant days, so I remember a really tough Mr. Gay back then. I guess our current council member is keeping up with that. We've got some calls here, so let's see what Eric in Arlington has to say about a climate change. Eric, you're on the air. Hello, Eric. Okay.
We lost Eric.
We lost Eric, but we've got Lewis in Ortega talking about diversity. Okay. Lewis, you're on the air.
Hi, Lewis.
Hey there. Good morning. How's everybody?
Good.
Good. Mayor, I think that the way you're able to reach across the aisle and work together with folks is admirable. I just have a question about the word diversity. And I'm curious to know, is diversity like a buzzword? Because we're trying to figure out if you have any Black Republicans on the African American Advisory Board. because we know that some applied, we know that some got declined, and there is a group of us that are in the Republican Party that are saying to current Republicans, hey, you know, we have to compromise on some issues without compromising the Republic. And it's like, how can we be preaching that message to them that, hey, it's a new day, but then we're being rebuffed when we're trying to come together and work with Democrats as people who care about the Black community?
Well, I can tell you that that party did not play a part in any of those discussions in terms of who made that that advisory board. I was not the one who personally made those selections, but I can tell you that it's made up of a number of wonderful people, and there were more than 100 that applied, and we could only choose 11. So I certainly hear your point, but I can tell you that I don't believe that anybody who made those choices based on party. But I absolutely appreciate your point.
Now we've got Eric from Arlington back, and he's going to be talking about climate. So Eric, you're on the air. What's your question?
Question is, it's obvious that if we wait for builders and developers and corporations to fix the climate change problem, it's not going to happen. We're not going to be able to mitigate it if we count on these vested interests. Recently in my neighborhood, as an example, maybe a mile from the house, they just built about 24 houses, maybe 30 houses, and there are no trees or anything there to obstruct solar panels, but there's no solar panels on any of these brand new homes. Is it within the purview of the mayor's office or the city council to start demanding, not asking, demanding, if you're going to build a new house within Duval County, if it wherever it's practical, you have to put in these things like solar panels and other things that will mitigate climate change? Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling. I don't think you ever get terribly far with people by making demands by and large. I'm not saying that that's not necessary in some cases, but what we are doing is we are working very closely with our development community. We have a new 50-year resilience plan. They are as anxious to make money as we are to make sure that everything works out for us resiliency-wise. And so they are working closely with us to say, hey, what are the places where we should build? What are the places that we shouldn't build? What incentives can we put in place to make sure that we are drawing people to the places where we won't have folks underwater? In terms of solar panels, to me, I mean, the idea to me would be, let's provide some incentive to make sure that
a program that they just started, so that is helping.
Sure. So there are ways in which you can incentivize people to do these things. I think people tend to I think where you end up with a problem, Eric, is sometimes when you're forcing folks to do stuff necessarily. And I'm not I know that sometimes that has to happen, but I think in this case, what you're seeing is a market that is going more and more in this direction. You're seeing, and we knew that at some point that this would happen, that basically it would become popular for people to start doing these things because financially it would make sense. And I think you're seeing that from business. I think you're seeing it from developers. And I think we just need to do a better job of educating people about that process and about the ways in which it saves them money. So I think you know from listening to me that I am very much concerned about this issue, and we are doing a lot in terms of trying to move our city in the right direction in terms of electrifying our fleet, planting more trees, making sure that we're creating green buildings where we can so that we can keep those heat and electricity bills lower. Those are things we're working on. So I appreciate the call, and I'll look forward to ways that we can continue to expand.
Well, I mean, right now I'm learning things just from the administration. The Four Seasons down the road, their garage will become a resiliency project. It's under the hotel. The hotel's built up. It will hold river water that floods in. The newest park on the old landing site, the first thing that's being done is to build up the seawall so that the park doesn't flood.
You got it, Dan. Yeah, that's cool. Exactly right.
And it'll be a cool-looking rock face or whatever when it's there to try to cut down on erosion. And so being done.
And it will save us money. I think that's what people need to understand over the long haul. These types of things, every step we take to prevent something terrible from happening is going to save us money on the back end. And it's also the right thing to do. So there's the benefit of that, right? But even with the stadium, the Jaguars are very much focused on making that a green building. And I think that's really an important example to set, and I'm grateful that they're doing that.
And just think about preseason. If we had the roof right now, people might not be passing out as they did from the heat.
Oh goodness, I'm definitely going to be appreciative of the roof for sure.
We got a call from Mark on the South Side regarding public schools. Mark, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. This might have been covered before. I try to tune in as much as I can, so if it has been covered, I apologize. So I understand, you know, they're looking at closing several schools around the county. I get that. However, just a couple of years ago, we had a vote where we increased our sales tax and the money was to be, you know, appropriated for the public schools. So you have hopefully some increased revenue there. Number two, when you look at the number of people who are moving into Duval County, the new tax base, I know property taxes largely fund the public schools. So number one, I'm curious, what percentage of our property taxes goes towards the public schools versus, say, you know, fire and rescue and other municipal issues? But for the life of me, you know, my wife and I don't have kids anymore in the public schools. We're paying the taxes, glad to, but I just don't understand how we can be short of money when we raise taxes, you know, voted on it, raise the taxes, mm-hmm. have increased people moving into our area, and we're still scratching our heads saying we got to shutter some schools and close things down.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think a lot of folks get confused about how public schools are funded. The state sets the amount of our tax dollars that go to public schools. We do not have the ability to raise or lower that. What you're talking about in terms of that half penny that's going toward public school construction was all to construct or to renovate public schools. There was a change in the way that that money is dispersed, where it also now goes to a lot of charter schools, and the fact is we have 24,000 less students now in our public schools, in our traditional public schools, than we had 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So when you're looking at that sort of a student mix, where you've got 24,000 less students than you had in public schools, when you're looking at the fact that now some of that money is being peeled off to use for charter schools, who, by the way, do not have to go by the same rules as Duval County Public Schools. They can use that money for whatever they want. The Duval County Public Schools, the traditional public schools, have to use it for school construction.
And there's been some state legislation that affects schoolings as well,
right?
Schooling projects. So
absolutely, and now we also have vouchers that allow folks of any income level to send their kids to private schools, regardless of how you feel about any of those things. You need to understand this has had a big impact on our public schools and the way that they are functioning. So if you have 24,000 less students, you probably have less need for some of those buildings. So they're going to have to make some difficult choices. I would suggest that if you do not like the way that your public schools are being funded, that you directly contact your state and federal lawmakers, because they are the ones that control the money that comes in for actual student population in those schools.
To talk about education of another way, your River City Readers program has hit the million-plus mark. And when we were over with some folks from the federal government just recently to talk about heat index, all the libraries are going to be opened up when the heat index is high, which is bad news for us environmentally, but they'll have books.
Right. Isn't that great? Isn't that just a wonderful double use of a facility? I mean, we want more people to use our libraries anyway, but the fact that they are cool places where families can go when things get too hot and the kids can have a place to read and parents too, I think it's a wonderful thing. But certainly something that we need to do, because we're hitting those heat index numbers more often than we'd like.
Yeah, we're pretty close right now.
But we're excited about River City Readers. We really are. That's been extraordinarily successful, and I hope that our kids will keep on reading through the summer. Really important.
And you're going to keep this going as long as there's a Deegan in City Hall?
You bet. You bet. I mean, this,
because there's been literacy programs in this city. I've been here for 40 years, and they come and they go.
We're not going to let it go. It's too important. We know that the success of our citizens, and therefore our local economy, is going to be based on how well people are able to read. 70% of the people in our jails cannot read it at a third grade level. And if that tells you anything about the choices that people are forced into when they cannot, or that they make, when they do not have the ability to really be as literate as they should be, then you see the direct connection to everything else. So it's critically important.
You just literally walked me into my next segment. the sheriff's office is asking for 40 new officers.
Yep.
He's asking for a budget that's some $30 million, I believe, higher than it was. And obviously, we're talking about moving the sheriff's office, moving the jail. The jail may be a little more to the forefront. Your thoughts about law enforcement's operation and justice's operation maybe moving somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that's your next big budget discussion.
Yeah, that's going to be the next big rock, I think, is where we're going to put the jail and when what the timing is going to be on that, whether we're going to build it ourselves or whether we're going to have somebody else build it and lease it. There are just a number of different options in that regard. But at the end of the day, that is something that we are looking at on the horizon. It's important that we do it for a number of reasons, but we also want to make sure that we can take full advantage of that property that's close to the riverfront. I think that's another big deal. But yeah, I mean, every place that I went during my community meetings, people said, you know, they wanted to make sure that we had adequate number of police officers on the streets. And I think when we looked at the number of police officers versus our number of citizens and the fact that we have, you know, it's a huge city. I think that we're right in line with that 40 officers that the sheriff would like to add. I think it makes a lot of sense. We need to continue to go in that direction. It's been tough to add those. Hopefully with our new agreement with police and fire, we'll be able to both recruit and retain officers at a greater level.
And you're happy, I presume, with the outcome of those union talks for both fire and police.
Of course. I mean, it's going to cost us a lot of money, but I think it's like everything else. You have to look at the return on investment. And I think that the return on that investment is going to be huge. There's not a bigger job that I have than keeping our community safe. And I think that if you look at what has happened over the last, you know, decade or so, I think there was a belief earlier that perhaps more police departments and fire departments were going to go to a 401k sort of system, and that didn't happen. So when it didn't happen, it really put our police and fire into a bad position in terms of being able to both recruit and retain talent. And if you can't do that, then it's hard to have a really effective department. So I'm really, really pleased with the agreement and glad we were able to come to it.
And you just walked me into the next topic, which is, it seems like we just
I'm so glad.
We just got finished talking about budgets and budgets and budgets.
Yeah.
And now you have, what, a week or so?
Yeah.
To present your new budget. Any priorities? Anything you can talk about?
Well, I'm not going to get into specifics today, but I'll tell you that you shouldn't expect any great surprises in terms of my level of priority. As I have said before, I think, you know, this is going to be a lean budget year because, you know, the projections of what we were going to bring in were actually quite a bit lower than what we are bringing in terms of our ad valorem taxes. And a lot of that has to do with commercial development that took some knocks because of insurance costs and because of vacancy rates. But at the end of the day, we still have to invest in those priority items in our city. I think now is the time to make sure that we're going as aggressively as possible toward those things that are ultimately going to be things that have a great return for investment for our citizens. So small business, affordable housing, you know, the riverfront, all those things that we talk about that are important, they are things we're going to continue to focus on.
Well, you know, you talked a lot about potholes when you were running.
Yes.
And there's a lot of potholes near my house.
Well,
so
infrastructure. Yeah. I mean, that's it. That, Dan, you know, if we take care of our public infrastructure, everything else will follow. I've said that a million times. It's one of the reasons I was so absolutely committed to making sure that we finish that infrastructure along the riverfront. If we do the right things with our infrastructure, everything else will follow, and we'll continue to beat that drum too.
And talking to the fire chief yesterday, we've seen a lot of improvements and development on the fire station front, but what other capital projects do you think need to be pushed? Is it another library or two? Is it drainage, parks? What might be prominent there?
We obviously will continue to make sure that parks are very much a focus for us. I think parks are critically important for our community, but also for our infrastructure, and we'll continue down that front. I think in terms of the riverfront, there are a couple of big projects. I say the riverfront and downtown. I think that related project on the South Bank is something that's going to be very, very important for us to support and get done. I think that's going to bring a lot more development. That's a company that brings other people with them. I think the Gateway Jacks project in the downtown is going to be a huge thing for us to focus on in terms of actually creating more of an opportunity downtown. And so You know, there are a lot of different things we're looking at, but I think that continued focus on what we can do to really, as I say, ignite that flame, that's what we need.
So what about the three, I call them the three sisters, the old bank building and the two towers that now seems to have stopped
the trio
and gone back? Is there any nudge that can be given from City Hall to try to get that on track and get that developed? Because I used to go into that bank. I used to have a friend there. That's a stunning building inside.
Well, I continue to believe that it's a very, very important thing for us to eventually get done. We are absolutely committed to making sure that the trio is preserved. Right now, we are not in a very positive place as far as those talks are concerned. But I have every faith that we will move forward in some way or another to make sure we preserve those buildings.
Because that would be a firecracker to set off other development, I think, in that somewhat quiet part of downtown.
Well, I think the most important thing, though, is you have to invest in development that that can get done. And that's really the important thing. So that's why when I bring up Related, it's a developer that they've been huge in terms of Tampa and what they've been able to do there and in Miami. Other developers follow them. They have the resources to get those projects done. Same thing for Brian Mull and the folks at Gateway Jacks. It's critical that we make investments that are going to have a return for us. And I think that's what we need to focus on. And I believe that at some point we will get there with the trio.
Well, let's talk to Bob in Mayport about workforce development. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Bob.
You there, Bob?
Good morning, Mayor. First off, I volunteer with Florida Youth Maritime Training and the Mayport Waterfront Partnership. And I'd like to thank the city of Jacksonville for investing in workforce development by renting us or leasing us the property, city property in Mayport. My question is, I know you have plans for workforce development funds, but will they include funds for small nonprofits rather than just big nonprofits and colleges? Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, I don't think we have anything. We're not opposed to small nonprofits. We're going to have a committee that will actually look at all of that in the ways that we can best drive workforce development. You know, I've made a big point of saying that our small and emerging businesses in Jacksonville are a key focus for us. In fact, we have increased the number of JSEBs by double since I've been in office, and we're continuing to focus on small business. But I am certainly not opposed at all to small nonprofits, and I think we'll have a committee that takes a look at all of that on the table and figures out what is the best way for us to increase the type of workforce that we need to get done what we need to get done in this city.
In a similar vein, we've been talking about the capital projects that might be discussed or nudged on the budget, but there's some smaller projects that will draw people into existing facilities. According to the draft documents, you've got some funding that could help the baseball grounds.
Yep.
You've got some funding for an ice plant replacement. ViStar Veterans Memorial has some restroom replacement funding in there, and the Ritz Theater, which is a shadow of what it was when I first came here. It's a pity, but is very useful. I've seen some cool concerts there. The Civic Orchestra does great there. There's some money there as well.
Yeah.
That's obviously to draw people into La Villa, to draw people into downtown where they might see some potential for development.
Well, as was pointed out during the stadium discussion, we haven't always done a great job of keeping our facilities up. And I think that, you know, you understand why, right? There's a lot of budget competition, but it's sort of like the same thing with infrastructure. If you're not taking care of the things that you have, it's going to be very, very difficult to maintain and grow them. So those types of things are very important. Like I said, not particularly sexy, perhaps, but very important to invest in.
The Rise Doro was a sad, sad day in the city. Here was a much anticipated apartment community right smack in the middle of a lot of fun stuff. Now it's the shell, but the word is, hey, we're going to rebuild real soon. Your thoughts on that?
That is absolutely happening. They are preparing to rebuild, and really they did a wonderful job in terms of making sure that that particular tragedy did not affect the people around them in any sort of great measure. I mean, that building could have fallen in at any moment. And they helped to get that in line very quickly, and the city has helped them to get back into the position where they can begin construction, and I'm grateful for that. We need that. That's part of that whole downtown revitalization we're talking about, and it's right there on the cusp of what we're going to be working on next too, which is the entertainment district
there
by the Jaguar Stadium and the east side,
right, sure. Right down the street.
You bet.
So the question I have is, on the last day of, almost the last day of the month, you had your Pride Month celebration. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's odd to celebrate something that started 20 some odd days earlier. So why was that held on Friday? Or was it just because you could key it into the New York City gay club protest and the anniversary of that? Because that was a wonderful event. I covered it remotely and I couldn't stop grinning.
Yeah, I think that was I think that was really primarily the reason that was the lineup with the dates. But that was something we scheduled a long time ago. There were Pride events that happened all during the month. So this was just a matter of the city making sure that we added our voice to that, and that it's been our goal, whether it's been with the Pride event or with all the different events celebrating the different types of communities, whether it's the Asian community or the Arab community or the Black community, you know, all of the different communities that make up what I like to call the beautiful mosaic that is Jacksonville. I just think it's really important that whenever we have the opportunity that we celebrate the fact that we have a pretty beautiful, diverse community here. And I love to be able to celebrate it. And I thought that was a beautiful day as well.
Okay, now we have another question here. We got Eugene on the north side talking about just some items. So Eugene, you're on the air if you're here. Eugene?
Hey, good morning to the staff and the host. Can you hear me?
I can hear you great.
Okay. Two quick questions. One is, I'm concerned. I do outside landscape type work, and the way subdivisions and complexes, apartments, et cetera, are being erected, they're building them almost like a desert. They go in, and I mean, they completely wipe out every tree, shrub, and whatever you want to call it. And when they put the houses in, the people are living in the desert.
Yep.
And it's so extremely hot.
Yep.
Is there someone that's oversighting that program?
Yes. I will tell you that we are very focused on that right now, because unfortunately what has happened in some cases is that it is just cheaper for the developer to come in and mow down the trees and pay into the tree fund. We've got, millions upon millions in the tree fund. And I think we have to find a way to create a scenario where that's not as easy as it is. We really need to make sure that the tree canopy, especially in areas that are struggling with that, that we don't lose that. We're planting trees at a rate that, you know, we are planting a lot of trees. I've got Ashante Green as our sustainability manager, who is very focused on making sure that we increase the tree canopy around the areas in the city that are 10 to 15 degrees higher, because they simply don't have trees. And we both need to educate our development community, and we need to make it less attractive to just mow down the trees and pay into the tree fund.
Well, having attended the two town hall meetings on Metropolitan Park, the primary push for the first meeting was keep the trees, which were planted there in the 80s. And then lo and behold, all three initial proposals have managed to save a lot of those old growth oak trees out there and bring in some new ones. So trust
me. And talk about what improves your property value. My goodness, what would you rather, you know, what do you think would improve your property value more, to mow down all the trees and to have, as he says, you know, a place in the desert, or to have these lush, beautiful trees that look like you actually have a community there? But the heat is an issue, and we have to really become mindful of that in terms of these things. We've got to have more trees.
Even to hear from you, the discussion recently about heat resistant or reflective pavement. Again, I'm not a scientist. I didn't know that stuff existed.
Yeah.
So.
Very true.
And then just to move on, trees, though, unfortunately, become the first victims of a tornado or a hurricane, which we may be seeing more of. Ask the folks in Mandarin along Mandarin Road. All those 100-year-old oaks have just toppled over the years. There's a concern there to find a resilient way to get your shade, but not cause a problem falling on people, cars, homes, whatever.
Well, look, we need to make sure that we're keeping up with tree trimming, which is another one of those things that we increased the budget for when we got into this budget year, for mowing and trimming and all those things. So I think a lot of that comes about when you have trees that are not maintained. Certainly, I don't think we can use hurricanes or tornadoes as an excuse to wipe out our trees. I just think that it is something we have to be mindful of. But I think maintenance really will go a long way in that regard.
And let me have you pull out your crystal ball. We are talking, unfortunately, about what could be a very potentially harmful hurricane season. I have covered Memorial Park getting flooded twice over the past few years, and other parts. What are your thoughts, predictions as to how we will weather, the city will weather the next few months of possible storms?
Well, look, I don't have a crystal ball. I wish I did. But what I can tell you is that Andre Ayoub and the team in our emergency management sector are just doing an absolutely amazing job. The communication is extremely good. We have a wonderful team together. People understand the challenges. You know, we talk on a regular basis. We have a thread that we talk through things. This whole event that just happened in Houston, you know, with a Category 1 hurricane, and you're seeing all the flooding, you're recognizing that with these extremely warm waters and the ability to rapidly intensify. I mean, you know, Tim told me the other day that if that storm had six more hours over that warm water, we would have been dealing with a major hurricane again. And so you're talking about from a 1 to a 3, right? And we're already seeing what the 1 brought. So we're dealing with a scenario where we're going to have to be on our toes to understand that these storms may very well rapidly intensify at a rate that we haven't really seen so much. And so that requires a lot more cohesion and communication and making sure that we're ready for whatever may come. And, you know, you never know what's going to come. But I think as much as a team can be ready, I think we have a fantastic team.
And a real quickie here, Karen emails, why not require steel frame apartments versus wood? Because we've had two major apartment complex fires in the past few years that have been multiple alarms.
Well, if you look at 90% of the building in any city, it is wood frame. Usually you see metal frame when you're talking about high-rise buildings. It is extraordinarily expensive, and I think to require that would be incredibly difficult and would put a damper on development. And also, there's no reason to believe those buildings aren't safe. You know, most of our houses are built with wood. We don't build them with metal frames.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a bit of, in my mind, a correlation there that doesn't necessarily exist.
Well, Mayor Deegan, it has been a delight talking to you. My first time having this amount of conversation with you. You've been listening to First Coast Connect with Mayor Deegan. You'll be back in a month with maybe even more news about budgets and things like that. So I want to thank you all for listening. And we've got some rather intriguing stuff coming up. We travel to a magical realm fueled by the imagination of a local award-winning children's author.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
20 minutes of reading a day paves the way to success. Use everyday opportunities to read. Signs, menus, and labels are all around. Turn daily errands into reading adventures. For more information, readjax.org.
The World takes you outside U.S. borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble. We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stick with you. I'm Carolyn Beeler, global news and inspiring voices that connect us with people around the globe. Join us weekdays on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, when a 47-year-old man has a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl who is his art student, can you call the relationship consensual, even if she thinks she's madly in love with him? What if they marry and stay married until his death at the age of 93? We'll talk with Jill Cement about her new memoir, Consent. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
How did NDAs move from the shadows to what's now been called the defining legal document of our time? Non-disclosure agreements used to be kept to the confines of high-end business in Hollywood. Nowadays, more of us are being asked to sign away our rights for a variety of reasons. Why are NDAs so common? We look at new reporting and share your stories next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we are back. Hey, parents of young readers will want to circle this date on their calendars. That's July 29th. That's when Jane Escapes to the Jungle of Individuality, an award-winning children's book by St. Augustine resident Jennifer Nestor, is being launched. Joining us to share that beautifully illustrated story of Jane with the bespeckled little girl that she is first-time children's author Jennifer Nestor. Jennifer, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I'm not going to forget this. So before we even talk about any of this, just read something from this because it's a beautifully illustrated book.
Sure. Happy to read an excerpt here. Jane followed Tim, Avery, and Claire farther into the jungle. She climbed on Claire's back and they ran through the trees. Along the way, she met so many other animals with special features and started to wonder if maybe her unique quirks really weren't so bad after all.
You know, it's interesting. She's a soft-spoken, quirky girl. She looks like she's got this freckled face, bright eyes, a little curly hair in there. She grapples with the challenges of being different in her own skin. She's bullied at school, and she wants to belong. So where did the idea from this come from?
That's a great question. The idea really came from a multitude of things. An inspiration of being a mentor for Big Brother, Big Sister. I had a lot of conversations with my little sister about what was going on at school with social media and bullying there and just the status on kids' mental health these days. I felt like the topic was extremely timely and relevant and definitely needed for our kids.
I mean, children these days have been the subject of many a news story and a sad news story that nobody noticed their quirkiness, their symptoms, their comments, and sometimes things turn dark. But we could talk on the positive side that if you see something in that child, you want to nurture it. And maybe the state doesn't let you, maybe the city doesn't let you, but you may have a budding Einstein, a budding Isaac Asimov. I'm sorry I'm bringing up real old names, but you may have a genius in there that needs nurturing with supervision, obviously. So is that where she comes from, and that's where you maybe hope this character leads some readers to?
Yeah, she, in the book, it describes her as being humble and quirky, but then also gifted. You could tell she's extremely intelligent, but because she's shy and quiet, I think that's where the kids around her don't really understand who she is and kind of look at her as different, even though she's just a regular kid trying to enjoy being herself.
You've got a lush book here with beautiful artwork, but you had to kickstart this thing literally yourself.
Yes. I am a self-published author, so it's a lot of heavy lifting as far as being your own, I like to call it like the CEO. You're the marketer, you're the writer, you're the the person that is out promoting yourself. So I actually ran a large Kickstarter campaign to help
fund some of the illustrations and the bulk orders of the books, because I did hardcover and softcover to make it accessible for everyone from a price point, whether they purchase it online or at an event. So the campaign was successful. We were fully funded, and that was something that was really exciting and rewarding for me to be able to, you know, show people not just one line from the book, but they were able to see a video, some of the illustrations, and then the context behind the story.
So where can someone find this book? If you're self-published, you're from St. Augustine,
yeah.
There's lots of fun little bookstores in Jacksonville and St. Augustine. Where?
Yeah, so right now they can find the book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, and Books A Million. And you could also find it on my website at jennesterauthor.com. Right now, the book is in a pre-order state. And then, like you mentioned, on July 29th, it'll be live, where if they order it, they can receive it, you know, immediately for per regular shipping based on where they buy it from.
And just briefly talk about that author. This is stunning artwork. How'd you find that person?
Yeah, illustrator, Victoria Mickey, she's incredible. I found her on childrensillustrators.com as I was doing research of, you know, the best ways to self-publish a high-quality product. I really liked her illustrations. I thought that her work was beautiful, and she's actually from the Ukraine. And we've been messaging back and forth via email and through chat and so forth on Instagram. And she has been just as passionate about this story, which has been amazing for me to kind of go hand in hand with someone that truly believes that this book can make a positive difference in kids' lives.
One word answer. More books coming from you?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, that was two words.
Yes.
All right. We have been talking to Jennifer Nester. I want to thank you so much for being here. She has a brand new book called Jane Escapes to the Jungle of Individuality, and it comes out in just a few weeks, and you can find it. And I want to thank you so much for being here. That is our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send on either to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. If you missed anything, catch our rebroadcast at 8 p.m., or find our entire archive at WJCT.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Executive producer, First Coast Connect, is David Luckin. The show produced by the invaluable Stacey Bennett and directed by the very invaluable Brady Corum. Jamie Vallee, an old friend, is our associate producer. Daria Miranova is our production intern, and our theme music is performed by Club de Belugas. Join us tomorrow when education reporter Megan McCott discusses Duval's teacher vacancies, low test scores, and a safety plan in limbo. I'm Dan Scanlon. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.